This week's guest is Melissa Galbraith, and the show is sponsored by Sassy Jack Stitchery and the Embroiderers Guild of America. Spring is on its way, and that means the Nashville market is on the horizon. The folks at Sassy Jack Stitchery will be attending the show and hauling back a trailer full of the latest charts. Monitor the many designers who are participating in the show, make a list of the charts you want, and place your order with Kim so she can ship them to you as soon as the show is over. Be sure to place the orders as soon as possible so Kim can place her orders with the various designers. Sassy Jacks will have a shop at the Fiber Talk Needle Arts Weekend, March 21 to 23. If you're attending, and we hope you will, Kim will be happy to bring your Nashville order with her to save you shipping costs. Either way, place your order as soon as you can so you don't miss out on the latest designs. If you're someone who can never have enough scissors, check out the Golden Forge Scissors, a new offering from Sassy Jacks. They're available in red and willow green, drop-forged from a single piece of steel, hand-finished by Italian artisans, and are fantastic. Treat yourself to a pair today. Make it a habit to visit the Sassy Jacks website at sassyjackstitchery.com and join the Sassy Jacks Facebook group to keep up with all of the upcoming activities. Also sponsoring this week's show is the Embroiderers Guild of America. And here's a word from EGA President Lee Peacock.
Hi, this is Lee Peacock, President of EGA, and I would like to invite you to our first ever sampler retreat. Sampler U is being hosted in conjunction with the national seminar to be held November 18th and 19th at the Hilton Anatole in Dallas, Texas. This is a time of year when everybody's offering a retreat, so why would you consider Sampler U over the others? Here's a couple of reasons. It's two full days of class with popular teachers Sylvia Stecker of Running with Needle and Threads and Becky Nolan of Lucy Beam. There will be two full kits valued at $300. Lunch will be served on both days. Bespoke swag celebrating Sampler U will be given to all the participants. Registration is real time, so you will know immediately if you and your friend are able to attend. No waiting or wondering if you made the class. There will be access to shopping opportunities and exhibits. Plus, it's in Dallas, which is easily accessible from all parts of the country. And it's open to all EGA members as well as non-members. In Sylvia's class, you'll be stitching a reproduction sampler from 1818. You'll have choices of linen counts from 32 all the way to 46. You'll be receiving a fat hat, a straw by Weeks Dye Works, and 19 spools of Vicki Clayton hand-dyed silks. The sampler uses primarily cross stitches, plus a few eyelets. In addition to learning about the original stitcher and her sampler, time will be set aside to design smalls as companions to the sampler. Each participant will get to decide what type of small to stitch and will work on motif selection. Becky Nolan will be teaching a sampler sewing roll on Sunday, November the 19th, which will feature alphabets stitched in Smyrna crosses. During the class, students will also be making a small strawberry to put in the roll. The finishing fabric kit will include a coordinated variety of Liberty of London fabrics. Students will receive a project bag made from William Morris prints and an antique button closure. The stitching kit also includes a 4-inch hoop covered in Liberty of London prints and an antique spool wrapped with the finishing threads. So how do you find out more about this wonderful opportunity? Simply go to egausa.org and look for Sampler U. Register soon and join us in Dallas.
Thanks to Sassy Jacks and the EGA for sponsoring this week's show. Please support our sponsors. They make it possible to bring you top-flight artists such as Melissa Galbraith. Welcome, I'm Gary Parr.
I'm Beth Ellicott.
And you're listening to Fiber Talk, the twice-weekly podcast for the needlework artists. Our artist this week from M Creative J out in the state of Washington is Melissa Galbraith. Melissa, welcome.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, well, you contacted us to say, hey.
I did.
Yeah, and it was like, I looked at your stuff and like, yeah, we'll do a show. It's like, you know, why are you asking? let's go. So
let's record.
Yeah, fascinating. It was interesting somewhere along the way, because you live in Washington State, but you described it as living in the desert of Washington.
Yes.
And the Northwest is one of my favorite parts of the country. And at one time, I had a business trip where I flew to Portland, and then we had a small plane to Klamath Falls.
And oh, yeah.
I'll never forget watching out the window how the landscape changed from the lush forests to essentially desert. So that happens the same in Washington?
Absolutely. Yeah, if you're on the eastern side of the state, it's much more deserty farmland, very like dry. We get tons of sagebrush and tumbleweeds and things. And once you cross the pass over to the western side, you get all sorts of lush greenery, really much taller mountains, forests, things like that. So they're two very different places within the same state.
Yeah. Yeah. I just remember that it was almost shocking because I'd made several trips to Portland. And so to me, Oregon was just this, you know, rainforest type environment. And then we get to Klamath Falls and what happened? Well, yeah. Because we don't normally talk about the eastern part of Washington just in general. I mean, it's rarely mentioned. So a dry climate, I mean, let's do a weather report. I mean, is it basically dry?
Yeah, it's pretty dry. I would say growing up there, we got all four seasons. Like you would get snow a little bit in the winter. It wasn't super rainy in the spring, but it was very hot during the summer, like easily over 100 degrees. And then you'd get like a nice fall.
Oh, okay. See,
nice.
There we go. Oh, I love the Northwest and the Northeast in a heartbeat. Yep.
Yeah. One of these days on my bucket list.
Yeah.
The Northwest. Never been.
Oh, absolutely worth it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Summer is the best time to go because you get like the really beautiful weather. It's not super rainy and you can do all sorts of the outdoor activities. So I would definitely recommend coming in the summer if you get a chance.
Yeah, that
call my little camper.
Yeah, that it rains all the time thing. Don't buy that. That's just to keep people out. Yeah.
I mean, it usually does. The first, I would say, like 3 or 4 years when I moved from the eastern to the western side, it was the rainiest spring on record.
Oh,
and
right.
I had to get one of those happy lights because it was so dark and so rainy. And I was so sad. Like, it was rough. But now that I've lived here for maybe about a decade, I'm like, oh, it's rain. It's fine.
You adjust.
But it does take a little transitioning.
Had to get a happy light. Okay. Maybe I need that. There's days where I could use a happy light. I think we need to look into that. Yep.
So they're helpful.
Are they? Have you used one?
Yeah, I have one. Because you have days where it's like there's no sun for 10 days. And I'm like, okay, no, I'm solar powered. I need the sunlight. So I put it on. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah, happy light, just like 10, 15 minutes first thing in the morning, gets you that good sun, vitamin D, really helps. Like you don't think it will, but honestly, like after a week of using it, you're like, oh, I feel a little better.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Learn two things today. See, this is a good day. Yep. All right. So now we actually are supposed to be here talking about needlework, so we probably should do that. So needlework for you, almost all your life, right? I mean,
Yeah, so I was introduced to embroidery kind of like around elementary school age through my mom. My mom is the like craftiest person I know. She does everything from like bobbin lace to quilting. She made clothes for us growing up as kids. And growing up in a household like that, we really got to try all sorts of crafts. She let us like dabble and do things. And I will say I did not love embroidery at that age. I was way more into coloring. I just didn't quite have the patience because embroidery is a very slow craft. But I think being introduced and feeling like you can try anything, just pick it up and go, helped me get back into it as an adult. And now I find embroidery just so meditative and relaxing.
So you have that thing that we've run into this with so many people where they're introduced to needle arts of some form when they're kids, and then there's a gap, and then it comes back, and the seed has been planted, but it comes back later.
Yes, it just took a little while to germinate.
And a boring corporate job kind of made the germination, right? Or maybe not boring, but
Well, so when I graduated college, I worked used to work in like print advertising, and then I transitioned to communications. And everything I did was on a computer or in a virtual space. And I missed that tactile experience of crafting, making something with my hands, playing with textures and patterns, and really being able to just feel those materials. And at the time, I was living in a really small 600 square foot apartment and didn't have a whole lot of space for things. So I was looking for a craft that was small and portable and something that I could pick up and put down easily and wasn't taking up a lot of space, could take it on the bus with me into the office in Seattle and things like that. And I mean, I did dabble and try some other crafts, but embroidery really fit that bill and made it super easy. And I like quickly fell back in love because for me it's the adult version of coloring. You're like playing with different threads and materials and filling in spaces and creating textures and fun pictures and things like that. So it was like an instant love as an adult.
So how long did it take before you left the corporate job, or are you still doing the job?
Actually, I have been full-time in my business for 3 years now, but it did take a while. I would say I probably did the like hobbyist side hustle and then like small business that was like full-time but on the side for maybe about 5 or 6 years before I actually transitioned to a full-time business. And the reason is because like living in Seattle is so expensive, and having a like corporate job, there's a lot of like security around like a regular monthly paycheck and health benefits and all those great things. And like, you don't have to decide where your business is going and what direction it needs to go in and goals and things like that. But I knew eventually I did want to take my small business full time. And it just so happened that I signed up for a trade show in Chicago, H&H Americas. And had ended up having some like weird difficulties with like getting over there and traveling and things like that. So I was like, okay, well, like I either need to do this full time and make it work or not do this trade show and just cut back on things. And I knew my passion was in my small business, so I gave my notice and figured it out.
Wow.
Scary moment when you did that.
Oh, very much. Very much so. Yeah, it was because I am definitely somebody who appreciates security and like, figuring things out. And I had, I guess, considered this as more of like a couple years out plan instead of like a right now plan. So it definitely was like a lot of transition and figuring out like finances and how to make it work. But I'm so glad it really pushed me to do that because I have gotten to try so many different things. I've written a couple books, worked on some really cool collaborations and projects, and just things that I wouldn't have been able to do had I been trying to balance a full-time job and trying to do my small business full-time as well.
So when you do that, and I'm sure there's a transition period where you're just scared every day that you're going to make this work. But now that you've had it for a while, when you get up in the morning, is it a different approach to the day than when you had to go to the office?
Yeah, I mean, I just feel more, I think, relaxed, and I'm definitely kind of an A-type personality that has a list of things that I want to tackle and focus on for the week. I've gotten better about kind of planning out like weeks, months, quarters, and figuring out like where like the ebb and flow is in my business and what I want to focus on and when I have more time for pattern development versus like just needing to put a bunch of kits together for markets that I have coming up and things like that. And I've gotten to travel a lot for different trade shows now, and really just met so many amazing people to work with.
So overall, much more fulfilling than.
I think so. I also really just get to set my own schedule. So, like Lately, I've been taking a hot yoga class in the morning about like 9 o'clock, and then I kind of like get the dogs ready to go, and then I get into my studio at like 11 or 12 and probably like work until maybe like 6 or 7 at night, and then usually teach a workshop in the afternoon
Oh,
or
okay.
evening.
Yeah.
So.
Do you have to contain yourself? Do you find that you have to contain the hours at some point, or you'll just keep going?
Yes,
Oops.
very much so.
There it
Yeah.
is. There it is.
I mean, it's definitely not a like, you will work less if you work for yourself. You will probably work more. You will work nights. You will work weekends. So it's been my goal for like a while to kind of figure out that work-life balance more. And I've been really trying to set guardrails around that for the beginning of this year to get things in place to help make that happen.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Yeah. Well, I've told the story many times when my wife and I started working at home. We used to be magazine editors, and we had to have a come to Jesus meeting one day where we had to say, all right, this work has got to stop at some point, 5 or 6 o'clock at night, and it cannot go on the weekends, because we were just burning ourselves out because we just wouldn't stop. We had to, yeah.
Yes. Yeah, I mean it is really easy because like I work out of my house, so my studio is just another room in here, so it's easy to pop in and out. But I have gotten better about like closing the door, saying this, we're not working right now. We can come back later and the door will be open then. But like I would, just like watch a movie downstairs after the day and then work on like folding boxes or cutting out patterns or putting things together. And I'm like, that is still work. You're still working and like doing these things. So you really need to just like completely cut off and take a break.
Yeah, I would think it would hurt your creativity if you never took a break, and then that would hurt your business in the long run.
I think so, because when you're like essentially burning the candle at both ends, like there's definitely a time when you feel burnt out and stressed and just overwhelmed and kind of like, what am I even doing? So it's important to like take those breaks throughout to replenish yourself and just, your mind and body.
I would think that hot yoga would help too with the
Oh.
creativity. I've heard of that and I'm like very intrigued.
I have been really enjoying it so far. It's like I kind of started towards the end of last year and it really made like an effort to try to go a couple times a week. So it's been really a lovely way to start the day.
Nice. Nice.
What did the pandemic do to you? Did that accelerate your business or give you time to create? Or yes.
So actually, I hate saying this, but the pandemic was actually really good for my business because people wanted to dive into crafting and had more time for hands-on crafts. So I definitely saw a boom in kit sales and pattern sales. Additionally, towards the end of 2019, I had decided to pivot my business from like doing a lot of in-person markets to actually teaching hands-on workshops. And so at the beginning of 2020, I had a bunch of like great things lined up, like traveling for classes and things like that. And then the world shut down and I was like, well, what am I going to do? This is like what I had planned on. I need to figure it out. And thankfully, I had some really great friends around that time that were like, just do virtual classes. Like everyone's going online. You can use Zoom, it'll be easy. And everybody around that time was really forgiving, I think, because we were all trying to figure out the virtual space and wanting to stay connected. So it was a really good time to, teach virtual classes and figure that space out and have people work with you. And I would say probably for those like 2, 2.5 years when we were kind of shut down, I taught over 200 virtual workshops.
Holy smokes.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, you were busy. And that's okay to say that the pandemic was really good for your business, because in this world, virtually every discussion where it comes up, it was good. Sad way to accelerate businesses, but needleworkers really benefited all the way around. So, yeah. It's,
Yes.
yeah.
Yeah, and I'm super thankful that like after the pandemic, people still really are interested in crafting and wanting to have that hands-on experience. So I think the virtual space people were very much over by the time we kind of opened things back up. But I found a lot of wonderful like gift shops and craft studios and things that wanted to partner for in-person workshops locally, and also some not locally. So I've been able to host quite a few workshops still. I do about like 2 to 5 a week.
Of virtual workshops.
In-person
Oh, in
workshops now.
person. So you have then a kind of a good mix of virtual and in person then these days.
I would say I don't really do as many virtual classes anymore. No. I did film a Domestika course, so I have a virtual class that people can check out that way. And I'll occasionally do like a corporate virtual class, but most of my workshops at the moment are in person with people wanting to gather together.
You prefer that?
I do. I think virtual is challenging because you have to really be able to like demonstrate and like read the screens and figure out like how people need help and like what they're doing. And it's can be challenging because they might not be able to like show you or angle their piece in a way that you can see what's happening, versus an in-person class, I can walk around the room and give hands-on help and really show somebody with their own hands or like figure out why something's looking funny or if they have a knot in their thread, how to get that out. And just, it's a little easier.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Well, former teacher and Beth homeschooled her kids. And so, yeah, I know the walk the room, work with the kids routine. That's special too. That's fun.
It is. And yeah. I love workshops and teaching. Like I didn't think I would, but I really just love seeing people fall in love with the craft and like the aha moment when something clicks. I teach the quilter's knot in my workshop, which is how we make a knot at the end of our thread before we start stitching. And I would say like 9 times out of 10, people are like, oh my gosh, this is magic. It's like, I've never made a knot this way before, but it's so good. And it's just that excitement really makes me happy.
Yeah. I'm formally requesting now a private lesson on how to do that because I cannot get it. I know, and people do it, and it's just like nothing. And I've tried; I can't make it work. So I need I'll connect later for a private lesson on how to make the quilter's knot.
Absolutely, I'd love to show you. Yeah,
now, it is magic.
Yeah, you can do it, I assume, Beth. Yeah, you probably
Yes. Yeah.
I can't. I do one knot, and then I tie another one, so it goes right over the first one, and.
So my mom taught me how to do a knot that way, where you put a little knot at the end and then you try to do one right on top of it. Right. And I could never get them on top of each other. You ended up with like a line of knots that eventually you tied together in a giant glob. That took forever.
Oh, I'll give you a lesson. I'm an expert.
Perfect. We'll trade. We'll trade knot tips.
It's a useless skill, but I'll give you a lesson. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But I know that routine. I had one last night where I tied it down, and the next one was like an eighth of an inch away. It's like, oh, come on, really? Yeah. Mm-hmm. I brought them all together. Yep. Yeah. I'll give you a lesson.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, your designs, your embroidery designs are, you really have a nature landscape orientation to just about everything. And is that the environment of the Northwest that drives that?
I would say yes. So a lot of the inspiration I get comes from like my surroundings and also travel. I walk my dogs every day around my neighborhood. And honestly, so much inspiration has come from that, like seeing ferns and mushrooms and wood stumps and things like that. I have another piece here. You can see the view from like just a couple streets over. We have a view of Mount Rainier. And this, sorry, over on the side, is one of the new designs I put together. That's just like a blue mountain with some grassy meadows down here. But it uses a lot of different like textures to create different designs within the landscape layers. So this one was inspired by the view while I'm walking my dogs.
Yeah. Okay. So it is your environment then. And when you see those, is it take a picture, make a sketch, or just keep it in your head?
I do snap a lot of photos. It kind of depends on where I am and what I'm doing. Sometimes it's in my head. I find that having a reference photo is very helpful. So I actually just finished up another design that is this butterfly and flower piece here. And this one was actually inspired by some like plants in the neighborhood, but also butterflies I saw at the New Orleans Insectarium when I was down there for a trade show. Yeah. And just seeing the butterflies like fly around in the butterfly room and like land on different flowers and fly by you and things like that. So this one, I took some photos while I was in the butterfly room, but also mashed other photos together and flower inspiration and things like that when creating this piece.
Yeah, they're neat. Always
Oh, nice.
more hoop oriented. I mean, those two fit in a hoop. Is that what you tend to do most of the time? Is
It really depends. So the sweatshirt I'm wearing, actually, this one is some of the different stick and stitch patterns I have. They're like water soluble sticker designs. And these ones are really great because you can put them on anything you want and use whatever stitches and colors you want with it to then fill those out. So this is kind of like some strawberries, a pansy, and some daisies that I then just stitched on my sweatshirt. But I love
Okay, did
a
you
combination of functional
did you
versus decorative.
did you tie dye your own shirt? Is the
I did indigo dye the sweatshirt first, and then I was like, let's add some embroidery as well.
Yeah, I noticed you do in indigo dyeing workshops, and I think that is so cool.
Yes, they're very fun. I actually got into indigo dyeing because I wanted to create some of my own patterns and textiles to embroider on. And so indigo dyeing is just a really fun way to do that. And it actually inspired my Cyanotype Botanicals pattern, which uses indigo dyed fabric. And then, you know how cyanotypes are a blue print that have kind of like a white design that's the sun creates when you have the photo? This embroidery is kind of like a faux one of those. So you stitch those botanicals to look like a cyanotype photograph.
Yes, because cyanotype is kind of, I've tried it a couple of times, the real, where you do it in the dark, you paint it and you let it dry and then you go out and it might never work. And I kind of got frustrated by those and I've gone back to doing a paint, like an acrylic, one of the acrylic paints that kind of fakes it. But those are nice so that you don't have to do any dyeing.
I also struggled with getting it to look very precise with the sun because I think it's really hard. You have to get your plants or whatever you're having as your dyed piece lay really flat on your fabric or paper. And if there's any weird space in between the design and the painted cyanotype piece, or if there's wind or just anything, it can create weird shapes with your pattern. So it is definitely an art creating a cyanotype.
Absolutely.
Yeah, this is the part where I just step back and let Beth talk to you about dyeing and embroidering clothes and yeah.
Yeah, it's a yeah the this the we've been putting glass on it. I had a friend who had a she's I have this old mirror glass frame and I'm not going to do anything with it. In fact, she said she was going to throw them away and I was like, perfect, just what I need. And I've been laying those on top of my, but still if the angle of the sun is wrong, if I do it too early in the day, then you get weird stuff. But it's fun. It's fun to play with.
I think as an adult, learning a new craft is very challenging because we want to be immediately good at it and we're not. There is a learning curve. Yes, we might have some background and skills to help us with it, but it's going to take patience and practice to try something. And I kind of see that in my workshops as well too, where people just think they're going to be instantly amazing at embroidery and finish their piece in the 2 hour class. And it's definitely a lot of people are have maybe some set expectations where they're like, oh, this is a much slower craft, or it's harder than I thought it was going to be, or just it's a little bit different. Because when you teach workshops to kids, they're just so excited to get to try something new, and they're like, look, I made this thing, it's so cool. And with adults, they're so stuck on the finished product and the precision and it not looking exactly like the sample pieces and things like that. So I think as an adult, it's very important to give yourself grace and patience to try something and be bad at it before you're good at it.
Yeah.
Absolutely. It's playtime. Playtime. As adults, we don't give ourselves permission just to say, okay, yeah, that's just play. It doesn't have to be perfect the first time you do it. And it's not going to be, so just kind of relax and enjoy the process.
Yes, very much.
With your students, do you find that to be the biggest hurdle? Getting them over that?
I think so. I mean, There's always every class is always different. You know, you have like different things that come up in classes, and it depends on what we're stitching. Sometimes if we're doing clothes versus the piece that's in the hoop, and things like that, there can be different things that come up. But in general, I think it's just like helping to set expectations at the beginning of the class to be like, hey, we're not going to finish this. We are going to try out some different stitches. You're going to get to try this craft, see how you like it, learn some new skills and techniques, and then you'll be able to take it home with you to work on it later if you want.
So relax and enjoy.
Yes.
Yeah, we're not here to
Do you have
win
a lot of
awards.
repeat students?
Yeah, I actually do. So for my workshops, I try to like use some different stitches and different classes and things like that, or stitch on different things. So, like I do some more beginner classes where we'll do like maybe like mushrooms or wildflowers, but there's different stitches within the different classes. So even if you took the mushrooms class, you'd learn something different in the wildflowers class. And then I do some like clothing embroidery classes. We do fabric landscapes where you get to play with like a bunch of fun fabric scraps and essentially like collage with fabric and stitch on top of that. I've started doing some more like mending classes with embroidery. And actually, we're doing a shoe embroidery class next week. So, yeah.
Oh yeah, let's
I
talk
love
about shoes.
it. Yeah, let's yeah, because you've got a new book. Yeah, let's just get
do.
right into the shoe thing, because Bess got stuff she wants to stitch. So a new book on embroidering shoes. So talk about
Yes.
how this whole shoe thing comes to be.
Yeah, so my second book is DIY Embroidered Shoes. Let me hold this on the right side here. And it really focuses on like how to embroider fabric canvas shoes. There are 15 different patterns in here, kind of for some set designs where you can embroider those specific shoes. It'll also walk you through how to create your own espadrilles, lots of different stitches and techniques. I do a lot of step-by-step photos in there. And then there are, I think, over 45 additional patterns on the back of the book. So you could also mix and match and play around with if you wanted to do like adding some like different animals or things, because there's like some birds and you can add more birds to it, or like bugs and other fun stuff. So I'll open it up so you can kind of get a peek here. So there's like a really great stitch glossary that walks you through all the different stitches in there. I really break it down step by step, and then you'll get to try the different patterns. So it'll walk you through exactly what's used with that pattern, the materials
Wow.
needed, and things like that, and then step-by-step
Wow.
photos for that specific pattern.
Oh wait, no. Come back to that. Holy smokes, that's cool.
Well, here,
So
I'll
just
show you the actual shoes.
And
So
for those who
Gary,
are
you would wear those, wouldn't you? Now, if you had a pair of tennis shoes like that, you would wear those out with a, yeah, wouldn't you?
I might, yeah. For those who are
Yeah.
listening, these are your standard canvas shoes, boat deck shoes, whatever. And all the way around on the side, she has a whole mountain range with like a sunset sky. It is so cool. Wow.
Yeah, I did them on two pairs. So these are kind of like more Converse kid style shoes that have a lace up front. And then the whole side here, I just filled in with a mountain range and kind of like a sunset behind it. And actually, these were the first shoes that I stitched. And when I was pitching this book to my editor, I didn't necessarily think it was going to be about shoes. I had wanted to do like some clothing and upcycling and things like that. And we went back and forth looking at like what's already on the market and what people were interested in. And we ended up niching down to only shoes, because she saw this sample and was like, these are really cool. There isn't anything else out there like this right now. Let's do more shoes. So that's why there is a whole book of shoes
So
now.
cool. So the shoe thing, did that grow out of embellishing clothing, stitching on clothing, and then you say, hey, what if I try shoes?
Yeah, I mean, I will say that like once you start embroidering things in hoops, you realize you only have so much wall space, and you're like, I need to figure out something else to do with this because I can't hang another piece of embroidery on my wall. But don't get me
Right.
wrong, I think you should have a lot of embroidery hanging out, but there is maybe a limit. So from there, I really started like diving into clothing embroidery. I would say at least half of my wardrobe is embroidered. I love doing like fun tote bags, like patches and things, and just adding additional embellishments, whether they're like functional or decorative, for your embroidery, as a cool way to use it that takes it maybe off your wall and into a more functional space for everyday use. And I think you'll get more out of your embroidery that way too. So it's not just something that's going to, be a piece of art. It's a piece of functional art, which
Yeah.
I love.
Oh, see, okay, like I mean, the shirt you have on right there, I mean, it is not my style, but I mean, it's really neat. So, it's got to be every time you show up with a piece of clothing like that or shoes, then your immediate conversation piece, where'd you get those? I'm sure it's where'd you get those? I want to buy some too. No, you're gonna have to stick your finger with a needle every now and then to get these.
Well, I think a lot of people know me by now that they're like, oh, she did that. Like, I'm
Yeah.
not gonna ask where she bought it because she made it. But yes, I think with shoes, a lot of people ask time, like, where did you get that? And there are a lot of really cool like Etsy sellers and also other handmade makers that will embroider your shoes for you with different designs. But I wanted to share how to do that and really make it feel more approachable, which is why I did so many step by steps in the book to break everything down so you can give it a try yourself.
Which I want to do. See, I
Okay, so
have
yeah,
some
so Beth,
shoes.
you got shoes. Let's see what you want to do. We got to talk about what this is going to work.
So this is a shoe my daughter gave me last year. She said, oh, Mom, you need these. And so, but I keep thinking, okay, you got these daisies on the front. I could just stitch daisies on them. But I've been afraid to poke a hole in there. And I've got more
I
daisies on
mean,
the side.
yeah, so your shoes have these really beautiful, like different, almost like fabric quilt patches that are in there that you could add embellishment to. And it looks like they have a little bit more padding than the kind of like canvas shoes that I was working with. So you'll just want to kind of, first off, I would take out the laces so that way you can really get in there and open your shoe up. Because when you stitch on a shoe that's more of like, I guess this one is a boat deck shoe that I'm holding up here. And because there are less of an opening here, it's harder to get your hand inside that shoe to then like reach down towards the toe box versus when you have a shoe that is more of this lace-up style, you can take those laces off and really open it up and kind of like, the sides become almost like wings where you can like really dig in there to like down by the sides or like the toe box or the heel box or wherever you need to get to embroider that shoe.
Oh, that
And
looks so
your
nice
sh
with that little bird on there.
Thank
That bird is so
you.
cute.
Yeah,
Oh,
this
it's a
one
purple.
also. So this one is one of those designs that I did some like additional patterns for. Like this bird has like a little branch that it's sitting on with some fun flowers in there. And then I added some additional birds in the back of the book and just switched the like angle variation of the branch. So it's the same branch that I used in the original design. I just switched it up for the other shoe and put it over here with another bird and then put it on the tongue here. So put the branch going across that way. And then I added a little cardinal on this side that he's hanging out. There's some little flowers there too. So you can really like mix and match and play around with how you place your patterns. You just want to like try to find the places that have less resistance, I would say. These shoes are don't have a whole lot of like structure in the heel, but some of them will have kind of more padding or additional like cardboard back there or something to make it much more stiffer in the heel box. So you really kind of have to like mash that, break it down. For your shoes, it sounds like you maybe have worn them for a little while since they're not new, so they might be a little like more worn in, which would be helpful for you. Versus like brand new shoes that are like super crisp and fresh out of the factory can be a little more challenging because they haven't been worn as much. And if you have newer shoes like that, I would definitely just try to like kind of work on smashing those areas down, breaking them up a little bit to make it easier to stitch with. And then like as we were talking about earlier, maybe getting some like pliers or needle grippers or things when you pull your needle through the fabric to make it a little easier because some areas will be thicker than others.
Now, do you put anything on the back of where your stitching is to make sure nothing falls out? Like, yeah.
Yeah, so I didn't. You can see on the back of this tongue here, and even a little bit inside this shoe that had the birds on it. I didn't put anything on the back. I think it's important to make sure to run your needle underneath your stitches and kind of tuck in your knots, hide your tails, and things like that, so you don't have a lot of like extra threads, and also not like jumping around. So I wouldn't have really long jumps of thread because those can get snagged and caught on things. If you are worried about that, you can get like a iron-on stabilizer. I know Silky makes a great one called Tender Touch, which is really soft against your skin. It can just sometimes be hard to get into your shoe to like iron that in there, you know?
Right,
So,
that's what I was wondering.
and honestly, like I would say most people wear socks when they wear their shoes. So you have like a natural fabric barrier between your foot and the shoe. So it should be pretty okay, unless you're going barefoot. And then that's a whole other story.
Ew.
My thoughts too.
Okay, so, all right, so now that opens the door to these technical questions that always come to my head. So, it really, just like any needlework, be careful how far you run threads. But in this instance, if you're going to run them any distance, bury them,
Yes.
so you don't have things snagging. Because that was my first thought, is if I embroider a shoe and then ran my foot in there, after a while the stitching's going to all come apart. But it's just a little extra care in anchoring, and then you don't have to really worry about it much.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I
Okay.
think with anything you're going to wear or like a functional piece of embroidery, you want to make sure that you don't have really long jumps of thread that are around on the back that are going to be seen or get caught on things. Same with the front of your embroidery. So you want to make sure that the stitches are pretty close to the fabric and short and flush, so that way they're not going to get caught on anything as well too. Which I definitely talk about in the book, and all the stitches that are recommended for the different projects are chosen that way. So you could still create a lot of like really cool textures and design without like worrying about the design coming apart after you're done stitching on it. So, and this is like a high top black shoe with some different plants and spider webs on it. So it's a little gothy, a little fally, but very fun.
Yeah, for those who are listening, this black solid black high top, and the spider webs are white or whitish. It Man, that is striking. When you put that one up, I was like, oh, I want that. That's cool.
Yeah,
Yes,
and it
there's just
glows almost.
almost, yeah. For the book, I really wanted to pick a lot of like fun shoe colors so you can don't feel like you only have to use white. Like these are some purple high top shoes that have some like a moon with some different beaded accents, and then just some really simple trees along the bottom that add some depth to the design. And this is like for some of the shoes, I did pairs that don't match. So this other shoe has its other mate has a full moon with more like densely beaded clouds, and then additionally with those like more outlined black trees along the bottom. So you can kind of play around that way too.
Well, I didn't even think about beads. Turn that to the angle so we can see along the surface there. Man, that's a healthy amount of beads. Holy smokes, that's cool.
It is. With this one, I really wanted to play with a little more embellishment. So like beads and sequins, and like maybe some like sparkly fun threads and things like that. So you can add some more decorative elements to your piece. I mean, and again, like with your regular stitching, you just want to make sure these are short stitches, and really secured very well. So that way they're not going to snag and get caught on things.
Wow.
Yes. Very neat. Very neat. And I like it that they don't match, because then you're not repeating the same pattern on another shoe, which I think would, that would be just so fun to wear.
Yes. Yeah, I'm one of those people that gets bored when you stitch the same thing over and over again. So that's why a few of the shoes don't match. They have like unmatched pairs. Same with this more boat deck style that has the under the sea. One of them has an octopus that actually uses a little bit of stump work for the head, and then kind of like some more textured seashells and coral and seaweed that are mixed and matched in with it. And there's a little bit of stitching on kind of like the sides there as well too.
Oh, this
I
could
already
get
asked my
addicting. This
sister.
yeah, this can get addicting in a hurry.
It really
Yes.
can.
Yes.
Yes. I mean, shoes are just another canvas, like anything can be a canvas when you stitch. And I think that's really the beauty of fiber arts. Like you can turn anything into something you can stitch on, and shoes are just another medium of that.
Yes. And I think that's making a comeback with my daughter. What did I do with it? Oh, here it is. My daughter, for Christmas, she decided to do handmade gifts. And so people are going to have a fit. Don't have a fit, people. She sewed on a pair of pants. This,
Oh,
now she didn't stitch this. This was down hanging in my basement. And it was one of our members who passed was giving away her things. And this was what Rachel chose, my daughter. And she didn't want it. At one point, she was going to throw it away. I said, don't throw it away. Just put it in the basement. Well, then she went and grabbed it and put it on a pair of pants.
Yes.
And it's just like, why not? Why not wear things like this? We spend so much time stitching. Now, Gary, you'd look a little different, but maybe
Not
you were.
happening. Not happening here. No.
But I think, the blue jean jackets, stitching on the back of those, putting some of those designs on those, it's fun. Why not wear what we love and start a conversation about it?
It is, and I feel like some of these textiles that are being used for this more upcycling trend that's coming around are textiles like old quilts and like things that are maybe damaged or not being used to begin with. So why not turn it into something that's going to get more life and like reused and repurposed? And that's kind of what I was hoping for with the shoes as well too. Like you could use new shoes, but you could take shoes you have and give them new life and fall in love with them again.
Right. And we
Oh,
go
go
through,
ahead.
we're such a throwaway society that to be able to take those things, I go to estate sales all the time and all those linens and things, they're being, one lady said, yeah, because I was there like a last day sort of thing. She goes, we are literally going to throw these away. They're going to be in the trash. And I was like, okay. So I took a bag and then took them to an art group and we took them and divided them up and dyed them and they made art quilts out of them. Why not?
Whenever I host
So.
an indigo dye class, I always have somebody that brings like old linens that are like, something they've had in the family, but they're stained or like they just don't really use them all that much because they're usually white and those things are like they just get dirty so fast. And so just dyeing them and giving them new life makes them you want to use them again.
Right. Absolutely.
All right. So
Absolutely.
the shoe thing, so it works best if you just have your basic Converse All-Star canvas shoes. That works best. Talk to me about the technical part, like on those boat deck shoes where you're down in the toe box, working that needle inside the shoe, that's got to be some challenge there.
It is. So in the book, I do recommend that you can use like a regular needle, like a longer darning needle, because the length will make it easier to grab as you like are inside your shoe, because you really have to like be able to get your hand down in there at that toe box. Additionally, they also make curved needles that look like a C almost, and you can kind of use that as well too to like angle your stitch in as you go, and that does make it a little easier for these like tighter toe box areas as well.
Okay. At some point, you just get used to working in such a confined space that you don't think about it, or is it always kind of a challenge?
I think it's always a little bit of a challenge. It does get better, like easier the more you do it, but it depends. And I will say, when kind of like doing some of these stitches, I did try to pick ones that are more like on the surface, so you're less having to like really reach in there and like grab from behind. It's kind of like you can like dip your needle in and out almost to try to like not be on the back as much. I also tried to figure out how to work some stitches in more of like a surface way. So like there's the fly stitch that looks like a V, and then you have like a little line underneath, and then you can connect another fly to it. With that, I figured out how to reverse it so that way you would do that little stitch, and then you kind of come up further up where the top of that V is, go underneath the line on the front of your fabric, and go back down on the other corner of the V. So you're working more on the front of the fabric instead of on the back.
Okay. So you figured those out.
Makes
All right.
sense.
Yeah. Oh, that stuff is
And
so
I'm wondering
cool.
even some whip stitches too, if they wouldn't work good because you've done your outline, but you maybe need something thicker, like on your tree branch. And if you whip it, with something, keeping it tight though, because you don't want it to rub. Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
Oh,
and
that's
for the
best wheels are spinning. Look out. Here we go.
Yeah, and for the book, each of the patterns has like recommended stitches and colors and things like that. But like I said, I want you to think of it as a coloring book, and if you have different colors or stitches you want to use, I definitely encourage you to explore and play around. I think that's the fun of embroidery and making something that's uniquely your own.
Now,
Absolutely.
best shoes with the kind of the quilt, patchwork quilt with little flowers and things on it lend themselves perfectly to just embellishing the flowers or whatever. But
Oh, yeah.
it looks like your shoes have some padding to them. So we're going to have to learn to muscle the needle through and back out. You have tricks for that too?
Yeah, so let me grab my little needle grippers here. They're kind of like those grippies you get when you open up can, like jars that are too tight. It's essentially those for your fingers. So they're like little soft needle grippers that you would stick on your fingers here. And then when you go to grab your needle, you kind of grab it on the side and pull like up or down instead of trying to push through. Because I notice some people will use the top of their finger and just like push down. And I'm like, don't do that. Your
Ouch.
fingers will hurt you. But if you can kind of grip, and they have kind of more of a like grippy silicone on the under pad of the gripper here that you wear, and that grippiness helps you be able to really just get a secure hold on that needle to pull through. Additionally, you can use pliers or different tools like that too. And as you were mentioning, Gary, having pliers that have more of like a plastic tip so they're not going to damage your needle
Yeah.
does make it a lot easier to pull those through as well too, especially if you're trying to reach more into like a boat deck shoe versus like a like a lace-up shoe that has more of an opening. So, yeah.
Yeah, they make and what I have pairs of these non-marring pliers, so they're regular metal pliers, and then on the tips, they're on the inside of the player tips are plastic, a soft plastic, so it doesn't mar anything up, and they actually are designed to be consumable because you get a second set of tips when you buy the pliers, because and there's a screw to hold them in because they figure sooner or later that plastic's going to give way. But so you, like on Beth's shoes, she's going to need some kind of an assist like that to keep from
I would
stabbing her
think
finger.
so.
And yeah.
Yeah,
I think so,
especially
because if
since,
not, it's thick.
yeah, it looks like some areas have much more padding than others. So, and especially some areas that are more like a suede fabric versus the cotton fabric, I would think that would be a little thicker to stitch through. But I maybe like try a couple of needles and test them out on the different parts of your shoe, just sticking it through the fabric and seeing how it glides. You might look for like a longer, thinner needle. That will like make it easier to pull through your fabric. Also, I would recommend getting like a thread gloss or beeswax or something to stick on your thread. This one I have here is Ponderosa thread gloss, and it's a scented beeswax that you just run your thread through, and that wax coats your thread kind of like a conditioner and makes it easier to glide through your different fabrics, especially if you have like thicker, bulkier fabrics and things like that.
Oh, that's a good point. That is a good idea.
So haul out all the tricks here. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
So in terms of thread, you DMC just cotton thread so we don't have running, or do you take some
Yeah,
extra steps
so
there?
I always recommend a color fast thread because usually with so with your shoes, you can either like there's a couple different transfer methods mentioned in the book. One of them is like a waterfall soluble sticker, and the other one is more of a carbon paper transfer, and the book will walk you through those two recommended options. With the water soluble sticker, you do kind of wash that away after you're done stitching, so you want to make sure that your threads aren't going to bleed. DMC is a really great color fast thread that is, I would say, like most prevalent for a lot of people. There are other brands out there that are color fast that if you like them and want to play around with it, I would recommend it. The book kind of uses a couple different threads, so you can test them out and like brands and see what you like. But really, I would see like use what you have, and that's fine. Just if you aren't sure if your thread is color fast, I usually recommend just taking a little bit, like getting it wet and then putting it on a paper towel and seeing if that thread is going to bleed or not. And if it bleeds, don't use
Good tip. If it bleeds, don't use it. Yep.
Yeah.
So you don't go to the trouble of pre-washing all these threads. You just, if you use DMC, it's
No.
pretty much color fast anyway, so just test a little bit.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I always try to buy color fast thread because I know it's going to get wet and washed. And it would really suck to, like, put all that work and time, energy into something you've stitched, especially a shoe, and then go to get it wet or be out in the rain and then find that it gets, like, messed up from all that hard work. So I always buy color fast threads. I would say it depends on where you buy your thread. And if you're not sure if it's color fast, definitely test a little bit of it. There are also some like shoe protectants you can get that are kind of like a spray that you would, like, after you're done stitching, you would just like spray it on the front of your shoe, and that helps act as like a water repellent, like stain prevention sort of thing. And that's always a good thing to add as well too, in case you want to add a little extra protection. Like, I live in the Pacific Northwest and it rains a lot, so you either only wear your shoes when it's not raining, or you add some kind of protectant on there to help it so it's not going to get messed up.
So do we, when we're first starting out, do we just go to the thrift store and get some canvas shoes to play with, or do you, did you just start out with new ones because you knew what you were you knew it was going to work?
So, this style shoe here, the one that has the mountains with the sunset on it, is actually the shoe you can get at most craft stores. I think I found these at either like Joann's or Michael's that are in the dyeing section. They have white canvas shoes that are more of this Keds style. And that's really easy because they're meant for crafting. So they're a little thinner, easier to work with. Some of these other more like Converse style shoes, like these high top ones or these more like low top styles that I have here, I actually ordered these off Amazon. They're like knockoff brands, so they're not actually Converse, but they're very similar. And I would just make sure to check the size, make sure they fit before you start stitching, because sometimes they can be a little off. And I have a couple pairs like that, not gonna lie. Or you could like these more boat deck style shoes. I just went to Target and like found some shoes on sale that I liked that fit well, and decided I was going to stitch on those. So it's really like, if you want to go to the thrift store, if you have shoes you own, if you want to buy specific shoes for a shoe project, it's totally up to you. I would recommend washing your shoes first, like just to like, especially if you're not buying them new, because you don't know, like, have they been washed? Are they dirty? Like, who's worn them before? And you're gonna have your like hands in there, maybe be like holding it kind of close to you as you stitch, and you just don't want something that's maybe not super clean that close. So I would recommend just like hand washing, or you can even throw them in the washer and dryer usually, and they work out fine to wash as well.
I'll repeat, ew.
Yeah, I mean, new shoes are nice because they're fresh and clean, but they also like haven't been worn as in as much, so they can be a little more structured and harder to work with versus like shoes that you've worn and have like been broken in a lot. They fit really well. They aren't as like hard in the heel and toe areas and things like that, so they would be easier to stitch on. But even if they're like something you've worn for a while, I would just wash them. Our feet get surprisingly sweaty even when we wear socks, and it's always just better to have a fresh, clean canvas to start on.
You eat through a lot of needles doing this, doing shoes?
Of all the projects I've done, I would say I broke more needles with shoes than anything else. Because a lot of needles are meant to bend a little bit, which is natural. Like, I have so many like slightly curved needles from stitching that I really love and won't throw away. But because shoes have like different densities and like, different structures, needles can tend to break a little more. So I would just, be careful and watch out when you're stitching.
All right, Beth. We're watching. We're looking.
I know. I know. I'm thinking. I'm thinking. I've got to run to town tomorrow, so I'm thinking, maybe I just get a new pair of shoes.
But I like your patchwork quilt things because your pattern is already there.
True, true.
You know,
And
there's a plus to that.
I've often thought about it. Just, not doing a ton on them because they're already kind of cute as they are. But, just
Just
adding a
adding
little bit
some,
more.
yeah, adding some additional embellishments. Let me grab another pair of shoes
Okay,
I have
sure.
real quick that I used a pattern fabric for.
Yep. Oh, Beth.
I know.
This is a new world here.
It is. It is. And I could, you know, and I'm not an outfit person, but I can see myself making shoes to match an outfit.
So these
Oh, those are
ones are
cool.
also some more like closed top slip-on shoes, but they have this kind of like almost quilt-like pattern as well too, with like little, what are they?
Oh, they're hexagon.
Hexagons, yeah, style pattern here with like different floral fabrics in there that kind of look like it's pieced together a little bit like quilting. Kind of similar to your shoes, Beth, but these ones I didn't embellish the pattern, I just did on top of it to add additionally to this. With that as well too. So you
Yeah.
don't have to use a solid color shoe. You can use any kind of shoe you want to embroider on here. And this one I added some like ferns and leaves and different mushrooms to kind of give it a more foresty forage feel. So,
Man, those really make a shoe something special. I mean, that is just cool. Yeah.
Yes.
And yeah, like when I was picking out different shoes to work on and things like that, like I said, I wanted to do like some basic white, but also different colors to play around with, and then also tried to find some like fun pattern shoes as well too, because I love playing with different patterns and seeing how they add to the design. My first book is actually all about how to like embroider texture and pattern, and uses a lot of cool pattern fabrics with the landscape embroideries to then like add different movement and textures to the piece along with the stitching you add to it. So playing with different patterns is just a fun way to add more to your embroidery.
Yeah, good transition to your other book, because that other book, it seems to me, from what I could see online, that book is really one for all stitchers, where different textures and how
Is.
to make things come forward and go back. I thought that in terms of utility, that book really lends itself to a lot of different stitching.
Thank you. Yeah, the my first book is How to Embroider Texture and Pattern, and it's all about different like landscape embroideries here. And as you can see, even by the cover, I use some different fabrics, some layers, and things like that. And this one has, again, that really great like stitch primer, talks about like using different fabrics, and it also has some fun 3D stitches in here. So you really create like stitches that pop away along with like dense stitching to create your landscape. So let me open it up here. Like one of my favorite patterns is actually this cenote inspired design that you stitch on tulle and then you add like a backing that has a couple different blues in there to create more of that like pond water underneath, which I think is super fun. So you get that different dimension with the two pieces there. And funnily enough, this one was inspired when my husband and I went to Tulum. And I would say I am not very good at Spanish, but I took Spanish in high school. And while we were there, I was like, I'm gonna speak Spanish. I'm gonna do this. I can totally do it. So towards the end of our trip, we were like, okay, let's do a cenote. Let's go swim in them. And they're essentially like giant like holes in the rock that where the water comes in from the ocean, and you can swim around them and sometimes go from like one cenote to another by kind of like swimming under an area. And there was a cenote placed by our like resort we were staying at, and I was so proud of myself. I made the reservation in Spanish, got the time right, like paid everything. I was so good. And towards the end of the booking, the lady was like, oh, well, we have Panchito and he likes to hang out by the cenote. And I was like, okay, I don't know what Panchito is. And like later when I looked it up, I was like, okay, like little peanut. So they have a little peanut that hangs out by the cenote. We get there later that day. We're all suited up. We go in and we kind of like snorkel around and we swim like in the first cenote pond, and then we swam under the mangroves to the second cenote pond. And there is a live alligator hanging out
No.
right by the side of the cenote. And the guide goes, oh, that's Panchito. He just likes to hang out. Sometimes he'll swim in the water. My husband looks at me and goes, are you trying to kill us? We are leaving right now. And I was like, okay, so that is Panchito. We are not making reservations in Spanish ever again, and we will now leave. Yeah. So,
Water and an alley, you're already on the wrong side of things. Oh, man.
yeah. Yeah, well, there were other tourists in this like cenote pond swimming around that had gone further out, and both my husband and I were like, no,
Nope.
we're good. That is still a live animal, and I am not trying to get eaten.
Oh man. Oh.
No.
And this
Yeah.
alligator was just fine with people around. It was just
I
no.
mean, it seemed pretty okay, but at the same time, like, I wasn't about to risk like having him swim next to me, you
Right.
know? I don't feel like I'm a strong enough swimmer to outbeat an alligator, let alone like anywhere near. And like later that night when we were walking by the cenote place, there's like a little kind of like angled path into like where it gets deeper into the water that you kind of just like walk into. The alligator's just sitting there and kind of like the lower like angle there, waiting for like mouth open, waiting for like little critters to come in so it can eat them. And I was like, yeah, that is very much a live animal, and I am not there to swim by it.
Not doing laps with the alligators. Nope.
No.
Oh, jeez. Oh, man.
Yeah, but it
Oh.
inspired a really great embroidery, and now I have a story to go with
Yes.
it. I'd have been out of
So
that
quite the
water so
story.
fast. Oh, man.
Yes, yeah, we left very quickly. But I will say other patterns in the book are inspired by like travel and going to like places in the Pacific Northwest. This waterfall on the front is inspired by when we went to Kauai, and then there's like Joshua Tree up here, some more like this other piece in the bottom here front that's also kind of like more Tulum based, and then we have like the mushrooms and things like that, and just some kind of more whimsical mountains. So you get kind of a broad variety of landscapes in here to create different textures and really fill in different spaces with some cool stitches and playing around with fabrics and stuff like that too.
Yeah, I enjoyed the waterfall one because it stood out for me because I felt like you really captured flowing water, and
Oh,
then
thank
the rocks on the side you put the depth in there, and I
you.
actually took a moment and studied that to see how you did the stitches, but it was very effective. Yeah,
Oh, thank you.
yeah, and this is all essentially self-taught. I mean, you,
Yeah, I mean, I would say my mom taught me some of the basics.
yeah.
I didn't remember a ton of it, but enough that I felt like I could at least pick up a needle and thread when I got back into embroidery. And really just kind of figuring things out for like how I wanted to do stuff. I had no idea what thread painting was, but I was like, connecting long and short satin stitches, just filling in different spaces to create like almost like coloring. And then I really kind of started like, learning more stitches, like using books, YouTube, things like that to kind of figure out different stuff. Sometimes I will say YouTube is hard because it doesn't always like tell you exactly what the stitch is, or you'll see a video and be like, oh, I really like that stitch, but I can't figure out what it is. So for the longest time, I was calling this stitch the butterfly stitch because it's like three straight stitches that has another stitch that kind of goes around the center that cinches it together. So it almost looks like a little butterfly. It's called the sheaf stitch, and it took me like probably a couple months to figure it out. But until then, I was calling it the butterfly stitch because I didn't know what it was.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Right.
Not the
Yeah.
first time that's happened. Yeah.
Invented a new name for the stitch. Yeah, that's great.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, I think
Why
with
not?
hand sewing as well too, there are so many different variations on stitches, and some like people might call one stitch something and somebody might call that stitch something else. So there's a lot of like crossover with stitches and things like that, and hundreds of different stitches and names. So something that you might call one thing, somebody else might call something else, and it could be the exact same stitch.
Yeah.
Right.
All right. We've officially gone way over time, but that's okay because this was so much fun. So what's coming up? You have classes coming up, another book. What's new on the horizon?
All those things.
Oh.
So I do have lots of fun workshops coming up. I teach in person and kind of travel around a little bit. So at the beginning of February, I will be in LA at These Cans Collective for a kind of like out of state class. But you can also join me at a lot of like Seattle locations as well too. And you can find out where all my upcoming classes are at mcreativej.com. I also have a third book that comes out this fall, which is all about stump work and botanicals and creating like 3D sculptural pieces that you'll be able to wear, and it has poisonous, medicinal, and carnivorous plants. So it's very fun.
Oh,
Oh, yeah.
okay. And that's coming out in the
That'll
fall
be
of
fun.
2025?
Yes, it should be out the fall of this year.
Oh
Yeah.
man. Poisonous
And
plants,
all
why not?
Well, I really actually what inspired that book is I love murder mysteries, and I feel like a lot of the ones that I love are kind of like Agatha Christie era, and a lot of the times they use poisons to kill people. And I was like, what are these poisons actually made of? What do they look like? And so I kind of like did a deep dive into like plants and stuff like that, and like found out there are actually some really beautiful plants that can be poisonous, and that's really what inspired the start of that book.
There we go. Okay.
Great.
Why not? All right. And
Yeah.
then the next one's going to be a venomous snake skins, right?
No. Oh, no.
No.
Gosh, snakes are one of the things that really creep me out. I cannot do
No.
snakes. There is a snake pattern in the shoe book, but it's more of like a cute, playful snake and less like I'm gonna kill you snake.
Okay.
But if it were a real snake, I would be out so fast.
That's Melissa's line right there. Cute, playful snakes. Okay. Got it. All right, Melissa, this has been a treat. Thanks so much for sharing with us, and both books available, and M Creative J. So the letter M and then the word creative, and then j.com is the website. Really great stuff. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's been a joy to talk to you both.
Yeah. All right. Thanks everyone for listening.
Bye.